Today on The World, we hear about growing concerns in Mexico over how authorities there are treating migrants heading north, chasing and splitting up families.
They take the kids first, so the parents would give themselves in.
I'm Carol Hills. Also today, the LGBTQ community in Afghanistan fears a violent Taliban crackdown like they experienced during the group's previous rule.
Many LGBTQ members were executed by Taliban, and I do believe that this punishment will be repeated again.
We hear how international groups are trying to help. And Komodo dragons are under threat. The big, tough lizards only live on small Indonesian islands, and locals want to save them.
They really wanted to continue working in harmony with the dragons.
That's coming up here on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Thanks for being with us on this Monday. We begin in southern Mexico near the Guatemala border. Over the last few weeks, videos have emerged from there showing Mexican immigration officials violently detaining migrants. Many are trying to reach the U.S. The eyewitness accounts are raising concerns among human rights groups and others over abuse. The World's Latin America correspondent, Jorge Valencia, is following this story and has this report. A caution, it includes descriptions of physical assault.
These videos were recorded along rural roads some 50 miles north of the Mexico-Guatemala border. Many of them are chaotic, like this one from 2 weeks ago. Mexican immigration officials and soldiers in riot gear chase after men running away with little more than their backpacks and sneakers. The scene is difficult to make out, but this image is clear. Two uniformed officers tackle one man to the ground, and a third one punts him in the face, then makes a failed attempt to stomp his boot against the man's skull. And in this other video, a woman says she lost her 8-year-old daughter, Adana, as they were running from authorities. In the video, the woman and a man are holding each other in a bear hug, with another small child squeezed in between them. A huddle of uniformed officers is attempting to separate them. I'm not going anywhere without my daughter, the man says. Adana was reunited with her family the next day. Human rights observers say Mexican authorities' systemic abuse of people attempting to migrate through the country's southern region has reached unprecedented levels.
We believe it's an effect from a much larger and complex situation.
Alejandra Elizalde is with Formación y Capacitación AC, an NGO that advocates for migrant women's rights in southern Mexico. It's estimated that more than 35,000 people from Honduras, Haiti, Venezuela, and other countries are living in squalid conditions in Mexico's southern city of Tapachula. Elizalde says many are now attempting to walk north.
People in Tapachula that have been stuck there for months and months, some of them almost for over a year, they're waiting to do their migration applications. Most of them, they're applying for asylum in Mexico.
Elizalde says government violence against migrants became common as early as 3 years ago when Mexico sent the National Guard to patrol its southern border. But she says that as people are attempting to seek work or housing in other parts of Mexico, authorities have escalated their repression efforts.
They've been using this method that implicates they take the kids first, so the parents would give themselves in, and this is all documented.
Nosotros lo hacemos, y esto es muy importante.
Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador responded at a press conference last week to complaints of abuse. He first says that migrants are breaking the law by transiting through the country without permission.
Es que tenemos que cuidar a los migrantes.
And then he argues that authorities are actually protecting the people they stop because most want to reach the U.S., and it's a dangerous journey to get there. Cesar Cuauhtemoc García Hernández is a law professor at The Ohio State University. He says he finds it ironic that the president of a country with a long history of migration takes a heavy-handed approach against migrants. And he adds that it's partially because of the influence of the United States.
When it comes to Mexico in particular, though, we also devote resources to funding Mexican operations through a number of initiatives as well as diplomatic tactics.
García Hernández says that in 2014, the Obama administration helped fund increased policing along Mexico's Guatemala border, and that in 2018, the Trump administration publicly threatened Mexico with economic punishment if Mexican authorities didn't stop asylum seekers.
Certainly the Biden administration is a world apart from the Trump administration in terms of rhetoric. But when it comes to the U.S. government's policies, they continue to encourage the Mexican government reducing the number of people who make it to Mexico's northern border and the U.S.'s southern border.
Garcia Hernandez says that even though the U.S. is an outside actor, abuses in southern Mexico will continue as long as the American government doesn't speak up about them. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
Now we head to Europe for a story about migration there. In northern France, the port of Calais is a spot many migrants from Asia, Africa, and the Middle East take off from to reach the UK. But they don't always feel so welcome in the city. Reporter Rebecca Rossman has the story of one Afghan man, a migrant now settled in Calais, who's trying to change that.
It's been less than a minute since Abdul Sabor has gotten off the train in Calais, and he's already getting to work.
Calais?
Yeah, Calais.
Calais.
You go with them.
Yes.
A group of Afghan boys approach him asking for advice about getting to the UK.
Yeah, there are 8 of them together. And some of them were young, like 15, 14, 16. But in this, there's no good advice. I don't know what to say.
But he's here to help however he can. For now, that means directing them to what's been called the New Calais Jungle, a field that's been converted into an outdoor shelter and food distribution point for the hundreds of migrants living in Calais. About 7 years ago, Sabor took a similar journey. While working as a translator for NATO in Kabul, he started getting threats from the Taliban. That's when he made the decision to flee and began an arduous journey towards Europe with the help of smugglers.
And it took 2 years in money time. We crossed the border, they will push us back and go like in forests, mountains.
The turning point for him came while living in a refugee camp in Serbia. After learning he was interested in photography, a volunteer gave him an old DSLR camera.
And she said, can you take some photo to me? And I take 2 photos. And she said, oh, wow, I like the photos.
From there, Sabor started documenting life in the camps. Then later, the rest of his journey to France, where he received asylum in 2018. Now in his late 20s, Sabor is an award-winning professional photographer who has traveled across Europe capturing the struggles migrants endure along the way, from police violence to homelessness and other kinds of mistreatment.
It's very important to document and reach our ways to the people and see, to show to the world it's not fair or it's not okay and how we've been treated. I think many people was not knowing like what's happening.
That's why Sabor splits his time between his photography and volunteering here in Calais.
So we are in a warehouse. The warehouse is cooking for the refugees, giving food.
He shows me around this old warehouse that's been converted into a sort of campus for several local NGOs that work with migrants, providing meals, clothes, blankets, and other kinds of support. Pierre Roque is a coordinator with the NGO L'Auberge des Migrants. He says Sabor's empathy and shared experience has proved invaluable when it comes to working with migrants in the field.
People feel like they feel like confident when they, like you talk to them, so it makes the thing easier for everyone, you know.
In the afternoon, we head to the Calais jungle to check on the boys we met this morning. We find them tucked away in the woods. They've found a leafy patch of grass to call home for the next few days.
They make a video for the TikTok. They want all of us to be in the video.
So we make a few TikTok videos posing in front of their new digs. But the boys tell us they don't have any blankets or tents, so Sabor puts in some calls. It's very personal to him.
It's my brother in same age, and my niece and nephew, they're trying to leave Afghanistan and flee Afghanistan, and it's war. And I know why they're here, and I wish I can do something to them, but I can never do enough. But I try my best what I can do.
By the end of the day, Sabor admits he's exhausted, but it's not over yet. He sees another group of teens engrossed in a soccer match and whips out his camera to document it. He wants to capture little moments of respite like these in his photography.
It's very powerful and strong, and it's very short way to explain of the situation.
Sabor says it's a way to show there's still some hope in all this chaos and sadness. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Calais, France.
You can see some of Abdul Sabor's captivating photography. It's at theworld.org. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro has a message for social media companies. keep your hands off our posts. Bolsonaro is temporarily banning a number of platforms from taking down content, even if it violates company rules. That means straight-up lies from politicians' mouths or whomever would remain online. This could help Bolsonaro's political fortunes. He's running for re-election next year, and he landed his first presidential victory on a wave of disinformation and falsehoods that went viral, a lot of it moving through the social media platform WhatsApp. It's a notoriously tricky platform to moderate. Ava Galperin knows about this. She's the director of cybersecurity at the Electronic Frontier Foundation in California. And she spoke with my colleague, Marco Werman.
Ava, why is WhatsApp so hard to moderate?
Well, one of the reasons why WhatsApp is so hard to moderate is WhatsApp as a platform is end-to-end encrypted. What end-to-end encryption means is when you send a message on WhatsApp, it can only be read by you and by the person that you are sending the message to.
And WhatsApp does this for privacy, I'm guessing.
WhatsApp does this for both privacy and security reasons, yes. The only way that WhatsApp sees the contents of messages is if they are reported to their abuse department as abusive, the equivalent of forwarding your message to someone else.
How have Bolsonaro and his supporters used WhatsApp? Like, how was it used in the run-up to his 2018 victory?
WhatsApp is sort of the messaging app of choice in many parts of the world. As a result, WhatsApp is used in the same way as Facebook Messenger or Telegram or SMS messages or any other messaging service to spread political propaganda leading up to the election.
So you're right. WhatsApp has 2 billion users around the world. It's more than a quarter of the world's population, which is crazy. Brazil being its second largest user base. What kind of strategy has WhatsApp come up with to moderate viral disinformation or hate speech with all those billions of users?
Basically, the only tool that WhatsApp has in its arsenal is reporting by people who are receiving these messages. If the people who receive these messages report them as abusive and they get enough reports that they are abusive and they find these messages to be in violation of their terms of service, then WhatsApp may take those messages down.
Do you think the approach that WhatsApp is taking to moderation, does it work?
It's not entirely clear, but they are certainly doing more than other platforms have chosen to do at this time.
I mean, this must be a really weird one for social media companies, especially after being scrutinized for not taking down enough mis and disinformation, not to mention hate speech and other things that cross red lines. Do you know how social media companies that operate in Brazil are reacting to this?
Well, Brazilian courts actually have a long history of ordering platforms to do things that they cannot do, including ordering WhatsApp to turn over the contents of messages, which they simply do not have, a thing which has happened many times. Brazilian courts have ordered the blocking of social media companies over and over and over again. And every time, Brazil has blinked. Essentially, when it comes down to it, most of the companies have very little presence in Brazil. And if it looks like the government is going to exert pressure on the company's servers or on company employees in Brazil, it is not particularly difficult for them to pull out. Unlike, say, Apple in China, where all of their phones are manufactured.
The fact that President Bolsonaro is effectively prohibiting social media platforms from removing content, what could that mean for the spread of disinformation in Brazil? What worries you?
Well, it's clear that what Bolsonaro wants is more disinformation in his favor in the time leading up to the election. Whether or not he will be able to bully WhatsApp into this sort of behavior, it seems very unlikely.
Ava Galperin, the director of cybersecurity at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And you're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. In some parts of the world, being an environmental activist can be a dangerous, even deadly job. According to a new report from Global Witness, a human rights organization, 227 environmental activists around the world were killed last year, the highest number ever recorded. Reporter Manuel Rueda is following this story and joins us from Bogota, Colombia. Manuel, lay this out for us. Where are we seeing these murders happen? I mean, which countries?
We're seeing these murders happen in countries that have internal conflicts or conflicts where lots of different armed groups are vying for territory, for example, in Colombia and in Mexico. but also in countries where governments are encouraging companies or settlers to take over natural resources in an unorderly fashion, which is the case, for example, in the Philippines or in Nicaragua, which had 12 murders of environmental activists last year. But since it's a relatively small country, it had the highest per capita rate of murders of activists.
Hmm. Is there a reason why we're seeing this uptick in murders of environmental activists?
Well, if you look at the report from Global Witness, it says that there were 227 murders in 2020. Out of those, half are just three countries, Colombia, Mexico, and the Philippines. Colombia has the most murders with 65. So in the case of Colombia, for example, the reason there's an uptick is that there was a peace deal between the government and the FARC guerrilla group 5 years ago, which helped the country in general, but that also left power vacuums in some remote parts of the country, where now drug trafficking groups or smaller rebel groups are trying to come in to take over that vacuum, to take over the drug trafficking routes or the logging or the illegal mining. And then that affects environmental activists, because environmental activists who are trying to preserve the forest or preserve sources of water from mining, for example, get caught up in the new confrontations over territory by these armed groups. So in Colombia, for example, according to Global Witness's numbers, the number of environmental activists murdered over the past 3 years has actually doubled.
What is being done to protect environmental activists? I mean, in Colombia or anywhere else? I mean, is anything being done given the numbers of them who are being killed?
I think that groups like Global Witness, who did this report, what they're doing, which is very important, is highlighting the issue, creating awareness about the issue. And then another thing are projects, even by the U.S. Embassy, to strengthen the local justice system. When it comes to these murders of environmental activists or any other kind of activists, really, one important thing is to make sure that threats against them are investigated when these people are alive and are being threatened, that they're provided protection. In Colombia, for example, many human rights leaders have bodyguards assigned, paid for by the government. And then if a murder happens, it's very important for prosecution to happen, because that's the only way you can discourage criminal groups from doing this again and again. So when it comes to doing something, it's very important, for example, to strengthen justice systems in these different countries so that they're more capable to go to places and investigate, to gather and process information. In places like Colombia, there's a huge backlog when it comes to prosecuting murders.
Manuel Rueda is a reporter based in Bogota, Colombia. He's been talking about environmental activists under threat in many countries worldwide. Thanks a lot, Manuel.
Thank you.
In Afghanistan, the LGBTQ community is concerned about the future. While homosexuality has long been criminalized in the country, advocates fear the situation will get more dangerous under the Taliban's strict version of Islamic rule. Many members of the community are now in hiding and hoping to flee the country. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
I recently got on the phone with a 24-year-old in Afghanistan. She identifies as a lesbian and for years has been a vocal defender of LGBTQ and women's rights in the country. People have been targeted for similar beliefs in the past, so we're not using her name out of concern for her safety. She's been on the move for the past couple of weeks, trying to stay out of the Taliban's path.
Now I'm staying with friends, but I cannot stay here for a long time safely. I will stay 1 week, but after that, for sure, Taliban come to your home.
Twice now, she's been told the Taliban came to where she was staying shortly after she left. She says they've asked for her by name, and she believes they're targeting her because of her identity and activism.
If the Taliban government be recognized by international community and other countries, LGBT and women will not have future in Afghanistan.
She told me she saw this danger coming a while ago, so she reached out to a man who she'd met through an LGBTQ Facebook page. He's also an activist and identifies as gay. But in August, the two of them got married, because they both knew they'd be safer under Taliban rule if they were in a heterosexual marriage.
I didn't want such marriage based on fear, based on escaping from Taliban. We are just husband and wife to be safe from Taliban.
The future of LGBTQ people in Afghanistan is unclear, as details of the new government and what laws it will enforce remain vague. But advocates say there's reason to be concerned.
Between the years of 1996 to 2001, many LGBTQ members were executed by Taliban.
Artemis Akbari is an LGBTQ activist whose family fled Afghanistan during the previous Taliban reign.
For example, in March of 1998, they killed two young men again because of same-sex relationship. They broke down the wall over them. And I do believe that with the arrival of the Taliban, these punishments will be repeated again. The history will be repeated again.
A Taliban judge said as much in July. He told a German newspaper there are only two ways to deal with a gay person: stoning them or crushing them with a 3-meter wall. Nemat Sadat believes the judge is telling the truth. Sadat is a gay activist and author from Afghanistan, now based in the U.S., but he doesn't think the Taliban will carry out these punishments in public.
They know that they need foreign aid money and they need international legitimacy. And so that's only going to happen if they abide by international norms. If they're like killing women and LGBT people, the world is not going to stomach that. So that's why I think whatever policies they do, it's going to be hush-hush.
Nearly 400 people have reached out to Sadat for help, including this 22-year-old gay man in Kabul, who I spoke with over the phone.
The situation for gay people now in Afghanistan is too much danger.
We're protecting the man's identity for his safety. Through tears, he told me he's not only scared for his life, but for his family's.
My father's life, my mother's life, my sister's life is a danger. Because of me, because I'm a gay, every day I crying with my sister, every day.
This man is one of the thousands of LGBTQ Afghans asking foreign governments for help. So far, Canada and Ireland are the only countries who have specifically offered refuge to the community. More than a dozen U.S. senators and 60 members of Congress have urged the Biden administration to do the same. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
This is The World. Paying for college can be tough enough, more so for undocumented students. They're not eligible for federal aid. But some states, like Colorado, are providing a cash bridge.
If we give them the opportunity to succeed, then they will succeed in our state.
Filling in the gaps, that story and more, coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Nuclear talks between the U.S. and Iran remain stalled, but a new agreement between Iran and the U.N. is providing hope those nuclear talks could relaunch. The agreement will allow the U.N.'s nuclear watchdog to reset monitoring devices at Iranian nuclear sites. Nehsan Rafati has been following all of this. He's the senior Iran analyst with Crisis Group, a think tank based in Washington. Nehsan, first of all, what does it mean to reset monitoring devices at Iranian nuclear sites?
Well, it means that the International Atomic Energy Agency has surveillance cameras. As part of its mandate for monitoring and verification, there are inspectors that go to sites. It does reporting on the state of Iran's nuclear program, but it also has cameras in place. And these memory cards are sealed and they're on the Iranian side. But what they allow the agency to do is to basically see what Iran has been up to while its nuclear program continues to advance. So it's one of those issues where it strengthens the one side of the international nuclear agreement with Iran, and which is monitoring and verification authorities.
Should we read it also as a nod toward maybe Iran being interested in restarting talks with the U.S.?
Well, I think that that's really the key issue in the sense that, you know, it sounds like a very technical discussion, and it is, in a sense, a very technical discussion of when we're talking about resetting cameras. Really, what I think the U.S., the three European parties, everyone that's interested in reviving the JCPOA were looking to was, will Tehran, would they make any kind of nod towards cooperative relations with the IAEA, and that could in turn lead to a resumption of negotiations? Or would they drag this out, risk a censure resolution, and see the crisis kind of continue to escalate?
And you mentioned the JCPOA, which of course is the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. That was the nuclear agreement struck between the Obama administration and Iran. You mentioned Iran's new, more conservative government. Does this news signal that maybe it's willing to engage with the international community on this nuclear program more than the previous government?
Well, I'm not sure I'd say more than the previous government. You know, under the Rouhani administration, which left office in August, they were the ones that originally signed the agreement in 2015 with the U.S. and the other world powers. And so they, you know, had a, you know, vested legacy interest in a sense to make sure that it didn't collapse entirely. Raisi and some of the conservatives and the hardliners that now control all of the centers of power in Iran have been much more skeptical about the JCPOA to begin with. So right now, I think that this weekend's trip was kind of the first major test of whether or not the Raisi government was serious and the Iranian administration now was serious about, if not necessarily re-engaging in the talks, then at least trying to stem a burgeoning crisis, especially if they faced a censure resolution at the International Atomic Energy Agency Board of Governors. So there's still quite a bit that has to fall into place to be able to say that negotiations are back on track. But I think you could also say that they are less derailed than they might have been otherwise.
When you heard about this and read about it, do you think, this is a good sign, this is good? Or do you think, same old, same old?
I don't think it's same old, same old. I think it's very, very tempered optimism. Optimism in the sense that, you know, a potential crisis this week at the IAEA Board of Governors has been seemingly averted for the moment, but tempered by the realization that there is still a great deal that needs to fall into place, including centrally the U.S. and Iran resuming their indirect negotiations in Vienna before we can get to a point where we can say that, you know, Iran's nuclear program is on the road to being more restricted and better verified than it is right now.
Nehsan Rafati is a senior Iran analyst with Crisis Group. He joined us from Washington. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
In the U.S., about 2% of all students enrolled in colleges and universities are undocumented. That's about 500,000 people. For them, one of the biggest barriers to attending and finishing college is money. They're not eligible for federal financial aid. Across the country, though, some states have passed laws to make college more affordable for undocumented students. As KUNC's Stephanie Daniel reports, Colorado is one of them.
College student Noemi Salas describes herself as a minimalist. Over Zoom, she gives a tour of her simple bedroom in the home she shares with her parents and two siblings. There's a bluish-gray accent wall with no photos, a bed, desk, and potted plant hanging from the ceiling.
I have too many things in my room, then it looks crowded, and I can't concentrate. It's just hard to focus.
She's really had to focus over the past 2 years. Until recently, the 22-year-old worked full-time as a dental assistant while taking classes part-time at Front Range Community College. Salas was born in Mexico and is a DACA recipient, also known as the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. She doesn't qualify for federal financial aid.
One of the reasons why I was working full-time is because I needed to pay for my tuition, and so I didn't think there was other options for me to pay for college. I just always felt like I had to do both.
Now, at least 7 states provide assistance to undocumented students, and Colorado, where Salas lives, is one of them. Under a 2019 state law, these students have access to money to help with tuition, books, and housing. Angie Piccioni heads up the Colorado Department of Higher Education.
We're trying to remove the obstacles to having all of our students get the education that they need and that we need as a state for them to get.
Colorado started accepting applications last October, and so far, 1,700 students have applied. But Piccioni says her office doesn't know yet how many of them have been approved.
If you apply for and you received all of that aid, then you should be able to graduate.
This is important because jobs in Colorado and across the country are changing. Many now require a post-secondary degree or credential. But some students of color, including Hispanics and Latinos, have a much lower college completion rate than their white peers. This is something Piccioni and her department are actively working to change.
if we give them the opportunity to succeed, then they will succeed in our state and they will be taxpaying citizens and they will contribute in great ways to the economic needs of the state and to their own personal fulfillment.
This option wasn't available for Marissa Molina, who grew up undocumented in Colorado. She started college before there was DACA or any financial help. She was even classified as an international student and paid nearly double in tuition and fees.
I actually almost dropped out of college my sophomore year because, you know, my parents, as you can imagine, paying $10,000 a year, $11,000 a year cash was a really hard thing for my family to do.
But then President Obama signed DACA in 2012, which allowed Molina to take out a private student loan her junior year. As a senior, she received enough in scholarships to cover tuition. It worked out for Molina, who is a permanent resident now. She paid off her loan, and today she is the Colorado State Director for an organization that works on immigration reform.
But I think the state of Colorado has also sent a message to his students about the importance that they have, that they matter, that they're seen, that we want them to succeed in our state.
It's important to get the word out, she says. Students and families need to know the application is available and safe to fill out.
So many folks in our community are afraid to share their status out loud, to ask for help, to ask for those resources.
Today I had this class for preventing medical emergencies and also radiology.
When I caught up with Noemi Salas last month, she was dressed in gray scrubs and had just started a dental hygienist program at Community College of Denver. We sat at a picnic table next to the dental building, and she talked about our classes.
We were going over, like, very basic things, like taking blood pressure, checking pulse, like, all that stuff.
The rigorous two-year program costs about $30,000. Salas recently received enough scholarships and grants to cover more than two-thirds of her tuition. It was enough money that she could quit her full-time job and become a full-time student.
It feels weird not to be working, but it's nice. I feel like I have more time to focus on my studies.
Salas already has a new study routine. She goes into her room, shuts the door, and makes sure her desk is empty. Then she puts down her laptop and opens a textbook, The Clinical Practice of the Dental Hygienist, to the first section. And now she's ready to get to work. For The World, I'm Stephanie Daniel in Denver.
In 1 week, Canadians head to the polls. Next Monday's election was called by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau way ahead of schedule. He's taking a risk, hoping that many Canadians approve of how he's handled the pandemic and will reward him with a Liberal majority in the House of Commons. But it might not work out that way.
Canada is in the midst of a fourth wave of COVID-19. Over two-thirds of Canadians say now is not the right time for a federal election, as it is not even 2 years since the previous one.
That's James Yan, a correspondent for The Economist based in Vancouver. He discussed the upcoming election in Canada on The Intelligence, a podcast from our partners at The Economist. Polls show that voters are unhappy with Trudeau. The prime minister's main rival, a conservative, now holds a slight lead.
The Conservative Party is led by a man named Aaron O'Toole. And Mr. O'Toole is a former helicopter navigator in the Air Force. He is pulling the Conservative Party closer to the center of the political spectrum in a bid to win over swing voters in the suburbs of Toronto. For example, on social issues, Mr. O'Toole's predecessor said he would not march in pride parades, waffled on abortion. Mr. O'Toole, on the other hand, says he will march in pride parades. He is firmly pro-choice. On economic issues, Mr. O'Toole has shown a willingness to go against the grain of conservative orthodoxy. He says he is in no rush to balance the budget. He is pro-union. He also sees a bigger role for the government. In fact, Mr. O'Toole would even extend the Liberal Party's income subsidy scheme by agreeing to cover for employers up to 50% of a new hire's salary for six additional months.
James Yan says some analysts describe Aaron O'Toole as liberal light, but that there are some key differences between the conservative O'Toole and the liberal leader Justin Trudeau.
Although both party leaders support a price on carbon, Mr. Trudeau wants a much higher price of $170 Canadian per ton. Mr. O'Toole would cap that at $50 per ton. and Mr. O'Toole has been unwilling thus far to adopt a clearer pro-vaccine stance for fear of alienating his supporters, some of whom are anti-vaxxers.
In this close race, James Yan says the result will hinge on two things. One, how well the parties can bring together those on the far left and the far right. And two, voter turnout.
If Mr. Trudeau can get his supporters out to the polls, he can potentially remain in power, if not in a majority position, at least at the head of a minority parliament. In terms of vote splitting, there's a risk of vote splitting on both the left and the right. There are three left-leaning parties. Mr. Trudeau needs to convince left-leaning voters to consolidate their support behind the Liberal Party. There are two main parties on the right of the political spectrum. There's the Conservative Party and another party further to the right, a populist outfit called the People's Party of Canada, which is polling at a record 6% in the polls. And that could be a reflection of Mr. O'Toole's attempt to pull the Conservative Party closer to the center. In any event, Mr. O'Toole needs to convince center-right and right-wing voters in Canada to consolidate their support behind him.
That's James Yan of The Economist speaking about next Monday's election in Canada. We'll have more on that story over the next few days. Next, we head to the West African nation of Guinea, where pressure is mounting on the leaders of a military coup there. More than a week ago, soldiers in the mineral-rich country ousted their president, Alpha Condé. The soldiers, it turns out, belonged to a unit that was being trained by the U.S. military, which has called the coup inconsistent with U.S. military training. The former president is now in jail, and Guinea's neighbors are calling for the coup leaders to restore constitutional order. Writer Howard French has a long connection to Guinea. He's a former New York Times correspondent in West Africa. Howard French spoke on Friday with The World's Marco Werman about the coup and the connection he sees to the country's first post-independence president.
Why did soldiers in Guinea overthrow the president?
Condé's popularity and legitimacy had both crumbled in the last nearly year because he rejiggered the constitution in ways that allowed him to seek and win a third term. And the perception of Guineans that he was a good steward of the economy and of the national welfare was not particularly good to begin with. And that invited, I think, a challenge from the military. Not too much is known about the new supposedly interim government. What we do know is that at the sort of regional and continental level, both a regional economic organization called ECOWAS and the African Union are beginning to mobilize to put pressure on Guinea to restore constitutional rule. I personally don't think that that's likely to get the military to put Condé back in office, but it may force the military to concede to relatively early new elections.
So Guinea stands out in post-independence West Africa. It was dictator Ahmed Sékou Touré, who was admired by some in neighboring countries, but also deeply feared in Guinea. Who was Sékou Touré and what did he represent?
Sékou Touré is this character with a fascinating deep family background, the great-grandson of one of the final and greatest holdouts against European imperialism, a man named Samori Touré. And Sékou Touré, the first president of Guinea, came up in very grass-level trade unionism and rose to take a leading role in Guinean pre-independence politics and then parlayed that into becoming the leader of the country at independence in 1958 under very dramatic circumstances.
So Sékou Touré ran Guinea with an iron fist, but you met Guineans abroad who, despite Sékou Touré's brutality, long had respect for him. What was that about?
Guinea then was close to the height of the oppressiveness under Sékou Touré, and I was just impressed by a thread that ran through lots of the conversations back then from people, young people whose families had fled Sékou Touré's rule, who nonetheless had bought into a particular type of economic nationalism in which he said, it's better to be poor than to be under the thumb of foreign oppressors who are just going to send their companies in to rob us. Guinea was and remains one of the world's most mineral-rich countries, and Sékou Touré had never really done much to grant big concessions to foreign mineral companies. And these exiles that I was meeting said that they admired this side of Guinea. So this thought stuck with me and it came back to me as I watched Alpha Condé, the president who has just been overthrown, renegotiate mining deals with Western and other Chinese mining companies and try to get that sector going again. I think when we spoke at the outset of the interview, you wonder why Condé had been overthrown. I think another reason is that although he had opened the economy up to foreign companies, the living standards of Guineans had not really improved very much. And so this is almost, in a tragic way, a kind of fulfillment of the prophecy of Sékou Touré, that it's better to endure poverty if the alternative is to be robbed blind and not to see your condition improve.
But does that moral claim to Guinea sovereignty that Sékou Touré so defended, what do you think that worldview means to the soldiers who are now in charge today in Conakry?
Well, actually, I don't completely buy into this moral claim by Sékou Touré. I think there's a middle way. There's something in between being a closed-off economy and a completely open economy where it's just the Wild West and mining companies pay whatever bribes they can manage to pay and get these highway robber kind of deals. I think that the challenge for this military group or the people who are going to follow them, who hopefully will be civilians, is to try to find a way onto that middle path.
Howard French is the author of Born in Blackness, Africa, Africans, and the Making of the Modern World, 1471 to the Second World War. He was speaking with the world's Marco Werman. Komodo dragons look like they've been airdropped in from the time of the dinosaurs. These lizards, native to Indonesia, can grow up to 10 feet long. They have venomous saliva, and they're known to take down animals as big as deer and horses. But now, they're the ones actually under threat. Komodo dragons are officially considered endangered. That's according to the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, an organization known for assessing the status of species worldwide. Gerardo Garcia is a Komodo dragon expert at the Chester Zoo in the UK, and he talked with the world's Marco Werman.
So where do Komodo dragons live now, and how many of them are alive today?
They live in five main islands, you know, in terms of populations. Probably for the first four islands, it's something around 2,500, maybe 3,000 dragons in a very small island. If we go to the other side, the big islands of Flores, the population is really tiny. We're talking about 500 to 1,000 animals.
So all of these five islands are all in Indonesia, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. All connected in Indonesia. The species, it used to occur in a wider red distribution, but now it's restricted to these islands.
So what exactly is threatening the Komodo dragons?
But it's a combination of the usual suspects, you know, wide spread of the human communities on the different islands. And that obviously gives it a less space for the species. We have as well a serious impact in terms of illegal hunting. And then we have, which is the final one, is the climate change.
I mean, is climate change a real driver for endangered species generally?
In general, yes. We have seen it, that the impact that is going to be raising the sea levels, this is definitely going to happen on the islands in Indonesia. So we know that lowland islands will be completely flooded. A raise of temperatures means an increase of prolonged periods of droughts, which will affect, obviously, the vegetations. It will affect fires and affect the decline of the quality of the habitat and as well the prey items for the dragons.
I mean, it strikes me for a single species to be spread across just five islands and with those constrictions you mentioned, I mean, they have an especially small habitat. What do you think needs to happen to ensure the protection of the Komodo dragons?
It is. So the way that we can really work, empowering organizations like the NGO in Indonesia called Komodo Survival Program, this organization is working with the communities and directly supporting scientific advice to the Indonesian government on how to address us. And that it has a very clear point, is the good management of habitats. That means working with the communities on the best use of the agriculture. We're talking about working with communities to understand the importance of reforestation. We can secure the future of the dragons. Otherwise, we start going in a very slow process of losing it.
So you're working with the Komodo Survival Program in Indonesia, tracking Komodo dragons and using high-tech like remote-controlled cameras. What do you hope to learn with that research? How's that going to help?
At the beginning, there was all the study using baiting traps. So you track the animals with, you know, flesh, and they go inside to these enclosures. They start identifying the dragons out way smarter than we thought. So these animals, they were not going to the traps. So sometimes they were identifying that they were not dragons. And in fact, they were very smart dragons. They were not going on the traps. So using camera traps is a much better way to indirectly identify the presence of the dragons. And only last year, we knew what is the distribution of the dragons on the planet. With this technology, they give you the evidence of where are the last populations for these species, and hopefully now we develop the programs to protect them.
Do you have any Komodo dragons at the Chester Zoo there in the UK?
Yes, we do. We have a pair of Komodo dragons, and he's one of the key ambassadors for all the visitors. And the connection, the chemistry, you know, what's going on? Tell me about it. This is here. But if you go to Indonesia, when you start talking with the communities, the power and connection, you see them that they really wanted to continue working in harmony with the dragons, trying to find solutions, or you can live in harmony between communities and the dragons. That is the most powerful element to work with.
Gerardo Garcia is a conservation biologist at the Chester Zoo in the UK, where he joined us from, speaking about the Komodo dragon. Thank you very much, Gerardo.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
The Arc de Triomphe is getting a makeover. The famous Paris landmark is being wrapped in a shimmery blue fabric in a posthumous art installation designed by artists Christo and Jean-Claude. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
It's not something you see every day. Men in orange suits rappelling off the Arc de Triomphe, unfurling reams and reams of fabric as they go. 270,000 square feet, to be exact. This project is the brainchild of the late Christo and Jean-Claude. The artists were known for this kind of thing. They wrapped the Pont Neuf in Paris and the Reichstag in Berlin. But wrapping the Arc de Triomphe, that was a dream the couple had since renting an apartment nearby in 1962. Fast forward 60 years, and it looked like the project was finally getting off the ground. But then came some unusual problems. First, falcons were nesting in the monument, and France's Bird Protection League complained. The project was pushed back until after falcon breeding season. Then COVID hit, and the project was delayed again. And in May 2020, Christo died. The artist's nephew, Vladimir Yavachev, is carrying the project forward. It involved building a metal frame to protect the monument with 400 tons of steel. The fabric is polypropylene, sprayed with aluminum dust, custom made in Germany, and manually stitched together. Yesterday, a crowd of people gathered near the monument to watch the crew work. At one point, the workers and specially trained climbers stood on top of the Napoleonic Arch and did the wave. The crowd cheered below. You might ask, why? Why go through all of this? Yavachev says his uncle never had a why.
He never put a meaning to this. He always wanted to do the project, and then the 67 million French, it means something different to most of them. And Christo always said every interpretation is legitimate.
No one meaning, just something beautiful to look at. When the installation is finished, the cloth will transform the Arc de Triomphe into something billowy, something sensuous, and something ephemeral. The project will officially open on September 18th and close on October 3rd, when it will be gone forever. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Okay, if your curiosity is as piqued as mine, go to our Twitter feed to see the Arc de Triomphe in its dashing new drapery. We're at The World. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. See you tomorrow.